right, everybody. So today we have two former guests back on the podcast, Steve Hall and Alberto Nunez. How we doing, guys?
I was just saying to you guys how I've spent too many hours now just talking back and forth to people on social media because I'm that people pleaser where I don't like I've done a post trying to like call people out and then I don't expect a little bit of backlash. What an idiot.
Right. I was gonna say you gotta prepare for that. I don't think did either when was the last time you both competed?
Alberta just last year.
Yeah, I did last year.
So
No,
20
the year before, 22. Right,
22. Oh,
twenty
was
two.
it? Wait, we're still in 23, right?
Right.
And Steve, when was the last time you competed was when you had the pretty dramatic transformation photos, right?
2021, yeah.
Okay. So 2.5 years ago now.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that long. N neither with Alberta. That's why I was like, last year, right? No, it's already been a year.
Well, yeah, because it's always interesting to see the advanced guys competing because you have to kind of detect some smaller changes here or there. And I know, Steve, in your case, there was actually really dramatic changes. And I think there was, what, 4 years in between those photos there? And Berto, you too. I mean, I know like with the back specifically, like there were some notable changes. Obviously, we also just saw Eric Helms compete recently, and he had put himself through some calf torture, some other things. Obviously, WNBF Pro now, which is awesome. I'm just wondering from more of a, I don't know if I want to say outsider perspective, because obviously you guys know him pretty well as well. But what did you think of the showing in terms of like progress in terms of you think it was mostly like a leanness thing, or do you think it was mostly like a muscle growth thing? Where did you see some of the changes there?
I'll let Steve go first because obviously I work in closer proximity
Yeah.
to
I was going
Eric.
to say,
So I like to
Alberto,
hear his perspective.
you have a better answer for it than me because you are keeping closer tabs on that sort of thing. But I do remember an Instagram post that Eric did, and it was like the side by sides where he was trying to compare stage photos because it's like these are relatively replicable in terms of lighting and condition and tan and everything. And kind of it is that once you're at the level Eric's at, like it is, we can see it, but other people are like, looks exactly the same to me. Like, well, what are you saying? But I do it with my side by sides. I can show it to my parents. They'll be like, you've made that much progress in 5 years. Like, what progress? Like, that looks like it could be the same you. Just you've got more of a receding hairline. So, yeah, I think just the overall package for him looked improved. I wouldn't say there was like, I know he was working on areas like his lateral delts. He was working on kind of lower lats because he was trying to bring out that V taper. I think you could see it in his delts. I think that came through. And he like pointed out his calves as well. You could see that. It's not it like the first thing you come to when you're looking at bodybuilders on stage, but you could definitely see it was notable. But that's where I kind of see it. But like I said, I think Alberto would probably be able to pinpoint more specific. I think he was as lean as ever. He didn't look like he was very lean last time he competed too. So maybe he did get a touch more condition this time around, but that's probably something you see more in person.
Those calves were bad. I think that helped a lot. It was just bad calves.
Really?
And I, yeah, they were. They were
Oh
like they
man.
just to look at him walking, they would just annoy me. I'm like, so
That's
bad.
like my calves. I
was gonna say, this is why I will never beat Berto in person,
Beekeeper
or at least if I do, I will have pants on.
suit, right? I mean, there's just so much to a well-rounded bodybuilding game. Like the technical aspect, like there's so much you can do with posing that helps, especially when it comes to the action of competing. And he was already a good poser, and there was a few small tweaks that, I mean, we see it all the time when we go to shows. It's like, man, if you just moved your arm like 2 inches this way or that way, we'd have a completely different look. So they were very small adjustments, but a lot of it was just the top end physique was better. I'd say delts for sure. Lats too, but delts, I think, like Steve said, were the highlight. I think a lot of these changes, for the layperson, when someone is advanced, you can see them in person, like when they're on stage, like people's wives who are just kind of casual fans, like they'd be able to pick up on like, whoa, like he looks better than last time. But in picture two dimensions, That's a whole different skill set. Like when I view pictures, it's like you get it to the point where you're almost in the room with that person. And you know, Facebook has that like 3D thing and you can kind of like move around a picture. It's like you get to the point where you can kind of do that and you can kind of examine just how much girthier a person looks or might be in said areas from two-dimensional pictures. But yeah, I think overall it was probably amounts of muscle that aren't you can't really measure or detect. But again, it's like I made what is it, a thread on this a while back. Was it a tweet? I don't know. But like we grow so different from enhanced athletes in that with them everything grows. Right. So quite often you hear of someone putting on like 20 pounds of stage weight or whatever, but how it impacts the physique from a visual standpoint, it's like it's I'd say similar to a guy that's say early advanced in bodybuilding gaining 2 pounds because our organs don't grow, other structures don't grow. Like you'll see it with people is you know they like their face change. Like I always joke around how big would my head be had I gone in that direction, right? It's a block as it is. So yeah, like we don't gain as much stage weight, but on a smaller scale, when you know, if you just go one for one, a pound of muscle is a big deal. I don't think he put on a pound. He put on a few ounces, perhaps, but then you counter that with the fact that he got just a tad leaner this time as well. But l last version of Eric would not have had the success that he had this go around. And of course, it was like just, it was a bunch of different factors that made for a better package.
Which is such a wild thing, I think, in natural bodybuilding, because like, you know, and I appreciate your honesty there, like, hey, it wasn't even a pound, right? Because some people, I mean, I've seen some people like, well, I put on 2 pounds this year, and then you ask them again, oh, I probably put on 2 pounds this year, and then another pound here. And I'm like, well, did you put on actual 5 pounds of muscle? Like, probably not, right? And I think Eric is also very tuned in with himself, right? I don't think he would say, hey, I put on like 3 or 4 pounds of muscle, right? So I think people appreciate that. But as you mentioned, like, hey, on like on stage, you can see it in person, you can see it. I'm curious, as somebody who worked closely with him, and not, I mean, obviously we're using Eric as an example here, but any like super advanced athlete, can you, as the coach helping them diet down, tell along the way that this is going to be better? Or is it kind of like, hey, I'm just trusting, I'm trusting it, and then hey, stage or like, you know, contest day, you can really see it
Yeah, no, I can see. I can see.
throughout.
Usually they have to be like low teens.
Oh, that's still pretty high.
And it's usually their hard spots that you kind of monitor. Like their hard spots just look harder. Like we all have those spots where we just don't hold a lot of fat. Like it always kind of looks grainy and the texture of that area just a little different. So usually by focusing on those areas, you can kind of tell because those areas speak to you like louder. Like for example, on me, my hard spots are probably like my delts. Like they're always kind of like grainy and hard looking. So they look like they're almost single digit body fat when they're like 13, 14. So yeah, you're just looking at those areas where there isn't a whole lot of coverage via body fat and the muscle sits a certain way. But you can't tell prior to getting there. Oh, eventually you can.
I wonder how much that helps with motivation too, because I've said many times progress itself is motivating, right? I think Steve, you and I have talked before about, you know, sometimes we'll see somebody who's genetically gifted and everybody's like, oh, like they're so motivated. It's like, well, yeah, it's certainly a lot easier, right, when you have a great response to something. I'm more impressed with somebody who maybe doesn't have a great response but pushes through. So have you guys found that yourself, if it's time to get lean, when you are bulked up, if you really believe like there's clear progress, has that helped you kind of keep pushing compared to maybe a time where you thought, hey, I don't know if a lot happened here?
Yeah, I would say to your point of like people would be like, oh yeah, I've gained 2 pounds of muscle here or whatever. And I have found myself doing that before. I don't know if quite saying like those words precisely, but I'd be like, I like to give myself a little bit of like placebo of, yeah, I'm definitely like, I've gained some muscle here. I'm going to make significant progress. And it's tough though, because I don't often take the time to do like what you do, Dave, and take circumference measurements and compare them at like for like times and like for like body weights and regularly compare those photos over time. at this point, I'm just more like, I know the kind of process I need to go down. I know the road that I need to travel down to get to that outcome that is more muscle. Let's just do the do each and every day and keep doing it consistently over and over again and making small tweaks here or there. And I kind of have faith in that process, like the trust the process. Like I, in some ways, I can completely agree with that statement, but it kind of means that if you have to trust the process, you questioning the process is what the process is. Like there should be no trust. It just is what it is. But yeah, that's kind of where I come at it.
I guess like you don't have to trust gravity, right?
Yeah,
It's just
exactly.
so I do you guys either of you guys have specific plans to compete next, or is it just kind of like, hey, general off season, let's see what we can get?
Are we both next year, Berto?
I'd like
This
to
year, sorry.
join you.
I keep
You
getting
are
the years
23
mixed
still,
up.
right? I'd like to, but you know, with a baby on the way, we'll see if that's in the cards. But I have till May to pull that trigger, so
When is your
I
baby
guess
due?
it could be I could
Anytime.
have a child here today.
Oh, wow.
So
Okay. Wow.
we're on standby basically.
That's awesome.
The first few months, like get over those, see where we are at. I've never prepped under such circumstances, but I'd
Yeah.
love to. I absolutely would, and thankfully I have a partner. I brought up the idea. I'm like, you know what? I think I told her I was like 60-40, likely not going to compete, and she was like, I thought it was to be expected, right? And like she was like, no, you're doing it. It's what you love to do. So I mean, that was comforting that I guess I'd have that sort of support. But if it's just not the responsible thing, I'm totally okay with holding off another year.
Yeah. No, it's my brother's wife is due at the end of May, and then we both just got invited to a bachelor party at the beginning of May, in actually in Colorado, and I was like, how irresponsible is it for him to go if it's 3 weeks before? And I honestly, I'm like so out of touch with like when some people would consider acceptable. I'm like, I honestly don't know if the answer is you should absolutely not be going to this, or if like no, it's okay. So we'll see what happens, I guess.
If anyone can do it, Berto, it's you. Like I wouldn't recommend it to many clients who are having a newborn. Like, no, that's a red flag, delay. But if anyone can do it, I think it's you, Berto.
Thanks, man. I'd love to. I would love to. I would.
So I want to talk to you guys about some of the newer stuff that's come out research wise and some of the posts that have been on it. I mean, two that stand out to me are, as we continue to have some of the length and partial discussions, but then also we had a relatively new analysis on training to failure, right? And some of the stuff that have come out in that, and maybe, you know, I know for a while is, hey, you know, 2, 3, 4 RIR, some like Mike Zordos even saying like, hey, I think 5 RIR could maximize muscle growth. And then we had this, you know, again, this new analysis showing actually for hypertrophy, you probably do want to go to failure, or, you know, obviously there's different ways to interpret that. So actually, before I jump into the next one, which is volume, we'll go into that. Have you guys changed your perspective at all with recent discussions? I know Steve, you in particular, yeah, you know, I think when we talked even years ago, it was kind of more of the Renaissance periodization setup of going even to like 4 RIR. I know when you and I worked together, it was more, I don't know if we had too much 4 RIR, but maybe like 2 to 3. How are you doing it now?
Yeah, so with that meta regression did impact how I view things a little bit more because it just made it obvious, at least under the conditions of those papers, which were very low volume, like 2 times a week frequency, the vast majority of them, of course. Like it kind of makes sense, higher relative, lower relative, well, however you want to say it, the closer you are to failure, the kind of more of a hypertrophic adaptation you're going to get. That's kind of what people would say is like the lower volume you go, you kind of have to pull on that intensity lever a bit more. But I think it did also highlight the fact, like you said, some research had led to kind of the evidence space being under the impression like a 3 or 4 RIR set could be as effective as this kind of 1 or 0 RIR set. At least that's kind of what I think some people are interpreting that as. And I think it shifted me away from that thinking and being like, no, clearly there's something to this kind of exponential stimulus that we're getting as we approach failure. So that helped. And also talking to Martin Raffalo about kind of RAR and proximities to that, because that's where his PhD is in. And he was essentially talking through kind of customizing it a little bit to potentially the exercise or the rep range and things like this. And that helped because I had been in the kind of just holistic view of, okay, every muscle kind of responds the same way to RIR, same with exercises. Like, we don't need to individualize it to muscle groups or exercises. But now I've shifted that perspective where I'm like, yeah, I mean, I think the fatigue on a calf raise or a lateral delt movement, what have you, it is extremely low, no matter if you're going to failure or you're at 4 RIR. Like, it's just so much. And same for people's accuracy with RIR is not being as good when they go higher in reps. And so I'm like, well, the isolation based movements are typically higher rep anyway, so I like to push those a bit closer. So I won't go at a 3 or 4. I used to just kind of start a week one of a mesocycle when a kind of the exercise got challenging and be like, okay, cool that there. I've kind of got into that effective zone, kind of met that threshold. Next week I'll beat it, and so on and so forth. What that led to, I think, was a little bit too much volume and a focus on pulling on that volume lever more than kind of the intensity lever. And by being a bit closer to failure from the get-go, it's allowed me to not have to have set volumes going up into maybe silly numbers or feeling like I could do more, but man, I'm already doing like, don't know, 5 sets of like multiple exercises here. So it's allowed me to kind of keep that down, but still on the more fatiguing lifts, the big compounds, the kind of heavier loaded ones, I do like to start a little bit further away from failure. So closer to that 3 RIR for like a compound leg movement, maybe closer to 2 for like a back movement. So yeah, it's kind of all that information came out to just allow me to think about it a bit more critically, what I was doing, rather than just have in my mind, I meet a threshold for kind of relative intensity and then just match or beat. Let's kind of individualize it a little bit. And also kind of framing it with clients too, who maybe are, if they're on a lower volume, lower frequency program, we can do that if that's their preference or just lifestyle constraints. So I think that answered your question. I was kind of just that's kind
Yeah.
of where my perspective shifted a little bit. I don't know if it needed to shift that much, but I have enjoyed being that way and being less worried about fatigue and kind of the downsides of training as close to failure. I think I was more theoretically worried about that than practically experiencing it.
Yeah. I have additional thoughts, but what do you think, Alberto?
Mila Wolf actually said something a while back that I'd been thinking about, and no one has really brought up, and that is that I forgot where I heard this, but that you can just over time build up thicker skin for just training induced fatigue. Like Steve will tell you that you just get better at managing and coping with, for example, like diet fatigue. Like the longer you do this, like I'm sure there's certain segments in Steve's prep where if you were to put someone's brain in his body, they'd be like, what is going on? This is hard. And Steve is like, it's Wednesday, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I remember, I think for me, a lot of this came, this realization from working with powerlifters and dabbling with power, because from a training perspective, like their stuff is so much more fatiguing than anything we will do. It's a different world completely. And eventually, like those guys kind of learn to acclimate and handle that. So the same thing with a lot of this, like going to failure, is that maybe if you were a bit more conservative with that at the start, give it a few weeks, a few months, eventually it just kind of becomes your new normal and you acclimate to that, the repetitive bout effect, just like anything else. So a lot of this, what it's done for me is the new research. But then also, I like to stay hybrid. Like if you're in the trenches yourself and with your athletes, and then also you keep up with research, you're almost always like a step ahead of both in some ways. And which reminds me, John Meadows was probably the perfect example of this. And I remember a while back, John speaking of the fact that when you get to a certain point, he insisted that yeah, you need to take it to those places, maybe not super frequently, but it needs to be part of your training. And I think this is where, especially those very observant individuals who are enhanced, can be of great utility to us. And John was certainly one of those where It's like you can run these experiments, and because things happen at such a faster like rate with him, it's like a guy like John could compare that. Oh, when I did this, my calves blew up. When we started using more of these techniques, we saw some positive things take place in the training. And these are things that they can pick up on in a matter of weeks. Whereas someone like myself, it's like, well, I have to commit to this estimate for the next year or so, and we'll see where it lands. So yeah, I've picked up the failure. I think on average, my athletes were kind of running around 7, 8 RPE. Probably now it's like 8, 9. And I will say this, like going to failure with a good technique and well thought out exercises is not nearly as fatiguing as, I don't know, like a set of like low bar squats where you're like clustering or something like that. Like it's, you get to a point where it's quite a smooth transaction. And yeah, you feel it a little bit more than had you left one or two more reps in the tank. But again, a combination of the repeated bout effect, and you doing this more frequently, and the fact that you just become better skilled at executing these movements, like you feel like it's just the tissue that you are targeting that is quitting, as opposed to like, I can't tell you like what hurts. I don't know if I got DOMS in my soul or something like that. So yeah, much more failure these days. And I think athletes enjoy it too, because there's less question as to like how hard they are pushing. They know that basically a rep away.
Several points there. I'll try to make it concise. So the just to clarify, did you say that you think powerlifters are training in a way that's far more fatiguing than bodybuilders?
Oh, way more. It's not even close. It's not even
Really?
close. Like me peeled versus getting ready for a meet, it's different. Like I can't even begin to explain to you what hurts, but there are days where you're like just squatting the bar. Like you're like, oh, this is going to be an adventure. Just because of the total practice time they need with these lifts. And even though it's trended, I think, downwards over the years, still like squatting, most guys do it about 3 times a week. And as you get stronger, that becomes a bigger issue to balance. Bench pressing for most people is 3 to 4, deadlifting 1 to 2. It's at a different level. Nothing I've done with bodybuilding has come remotely close to the
You're talking
fatigue.
about even the actual contest prep of bodybuilding, or are you talking about training specifically?
They're close. I would say prep's a little bit harder, but that's because I've been able to push closer to, I guess, what one could can call human limits. Whereas like, I don't know what Bryce Lewis feels like, you know, 2 weeks out from Worlds. I could only imagine with his level of strength. So yeah, it's different.
I mean, obviously, you're more experienced than either of us, not just in bodybuilding, but even like especially powerlifting. When I just think of the type of training, again, I've not competed in powerlifting meet. It's not even close. Like if I think of doing, and I've certainly trained for strength, very dedicated phases, and I think of doing sets of, like 3 to 5 and even like more sets, I think it's harder on the joints, but man, I will take 8 sets of 3 on a squat over like, 4 sets of 12 breathing squats, like DC style, like just kill yourself leg days. This is my experience. I always find the higher reps much harder.
Yeah, I mean they're hard, but not like I don't know, like there's guys out there that it's like they weigh 180 pounds, and like their light squat day is like 5 by 3 with 550, you
Yeah,
know.
admittedly, I can't comment on that level of strength. I just don't have
Yeah.
it, I guess. But again, like relative to myself, it hasn't even been close. Like I remember not giving up on this, but I remember I used to have these insane leg days in high school, and I mean, it'd be like they'd be on Saturday, and by Wednesday, I was just like, man, this thing's coming up. And when I started to read more about, oh, like a 5 by 5 on squats is great. Like back then it was almost too far in the other direction of like squats are all you need. 5 by 5 is fine, whatever. I was like, oh my God, that's going to be so much easier. I'll do 5 by 5 squats, 5 by 5 RDLs. that's my leg day. Like, it just seemed like such a relief that I didn't have to do these horrible things. But I again, I don't know what it's like to squat 550 for sets of five and everything. So,
So no, my respect to those guys, because they give me too much respect for getting lean. I'm like, I've had a taste of your world and I didn't like it one bit. So, pick your poison, right?
yeah. I also wonder how much, I mean, you're obviously very good at dieting, and I know we've talked before, genetically, like, you're predisposed to it. I mean, I've heard people who were like Navy SEALs say, I did a contest prep, it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And it's just, I guess it's just perspective. I don't know if you have any thoughts on any of this, Steve.
On the training front, when I think about bodybuilding and powerlifting, I don't know if it's just like a psychological enjoyment factor, but I would like, I don't know if it's just it. When I think about the powerlifting training, when I did it and I have done one meet and I competed in one meet and then I was like, I'm done, I'm never doing it again. It was just, I found it so boring and
Boring,
laborious
yes,
doing the
yeah.
same thing over and over again. So that in itself, to me, I think about what you were talking about, like, I don't know, 5x5 RDL, 5x5 squat. I'm just like, man, no, please no. So I'll take the higher volume kind of hypertrophy, higher rep ranges all the time. But
Interesting.
I know what you mean in terms of, yeah, it's too long since I've ever trained for anything under like 5 reps, so I can't even comment on it in any sort of way. And I don't have any powerlifters that I coach anymore, so just all bodybuilding here. I don't know what your other question was now. Dieting, something about
Well,
dieting. Navy SEALs finding it hard, the hardest thing they've ever done, which I kind of can't believe. I'm like, the Navy SEAL training needs to be tougher because it's just a
Yeah,
diet,
well,
man.
honestly, you guys have, I mean, I less so now, and I do wonder if that's improvements in the information that's out there. But most of my time in this scene, people would talk about, especially again, their first contest prep as like the most miserable thing ever. Like, just that's just how it was described. Like, this is the worst thing that somebody could do. I've never gotten contest lean. I've gotten very lean, but not contest lean. So, but again, I almost wonder, relative to, like, you're both very naturally lean. I grew up a fat kid. I'm not saying that it's as hard for me to get to 10% as you guys would be, like 5%, but I do wonder, would me getting to 7% be as hard as you guys getting, I don't know where that number would be. But I imagine it's not exactly the same experience.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100.
Yeah. Just regarding the like, obviously, I mean, I think we all love John Meadows, and I think he probably is a good example of somebody who was able to kind of give good advice to both enhanced and natural trainees. But I do wonder, from the experiment standpoint you were talking about, I think with the right experience of somebody who's done a lot naturally and a lot enhanced, that is probably true, where it's like, hey, we can kind of speed up, it's almost like a, a time accelerator for some of these things. But I do wonder how many people in the enhanced world have the control to keep everything else constant with doing that. Because, like, it's so easy. Hey, I'm just going to bump my testosterone up by 20% even. Now you've completely clouded the results. So I do hesitate for the average listener to take too much away from people who have been enhanced for so long that they've almost forgotten what it's like to train naturally.
No, absolutely. Yeah. The very few guys are, I mean, look at how most people handle their pre-workouts. At some point, most people are like, I've gone too deep. I need to bring it back down to sub 500 milligrams a day. And with steroids, I imagine it's worse because, geez, that stuff really works. So yeah, people like John are, they're hard to find, man.
Were you saying that your average client, you said before, was like doing 7 to 8 RPE and now it's like 8 to 8.5? So were you saying, like, before, most were doing most of their sets at like a 3 RIR? Is that what you were saying?
3 to 2, and then yeah, it got bumped up slightly, eight
Okay.
to nine.
Yeah. I don't do it as much with mesocycles specifically. But the way I kind of look at it is, like, when I do a new exercise or I switch exercises, it almost takes care of itself. Not that you couldn't go to failure with new exercise, obviously you could. But like, I'm designing a home gym right now and I got this less than ideal leg curl and leg extension thing. But as I'm doing it, I'm like, all right, this is the first week. So I'm not gonna go balls to walls. Here's a weight. This is like you said, like an 8, 8.5 RPE. And that is in itself almost a little bit of a reset, where it's like, all right, now here's my ideal form. Here's taking it, like, everything's under control. And it's almost like within the exercise, I've kind of deloaded it a little bit. And now, over the however many weeks I can try to progress on it, I will get more and more intense. And to be honest, like, towards the end, there might be a little lax in the form, right? I might be a little lax in the form, not to any extreme degree, but that things that happen. And then eventually I get to the point where like, okay, this needs a reset. And then I kind of, will go through it. So I don't do it like a set every 4 weeks. I do a mesocycle and I reset it. But with some of the exercises at laterals is another one. Like every once in a while I feel like, okay, I got to clean these up a little bit. They've gotten a little bit too much oomph in the movement. And then I kind of use that to back off a little bit, maybe, 8 RP, and then go up from there.
So it sounds like from what I'm taking in that from that, Dave, you don't like do a specific deload. Your deload is just changing or reinstating technique or changing the exercise, and that brings down your RPEs or RIRs to a point where it's like a bit of a fatigue reduction. And is that right?
Somewhat, because I know Menno Henselmans talking about how he kind of just deloads specific exercises, and I don't love that. I think it just depends on the purpose of the deload. If a client of mine is like, "Hey, I'm really worn out," or like, I don't know, like something just overly sore all the time, I don't think just deloading one specific exercise is going to do what we want it to do. Especially if there's like a mental fatigue reason. I'm honestly fine even with weeks off. I understand like scientifically that might not be the best way to deload. But to me, it's like, look, man, you're going on vacation. I personally like to actually exercise on vacation, but like you want to do it, just chill. Chill for 5 days. Like I think that's completely fine. And again, from a mental standpoint, I think it can really get you chomping at the bit to get back in it. What I'm more referring to is not necessarily for the sake of deloading, but more just if I find that that exercise itself is getting like it, I don't know if I do it with the purpose of fatigue management as much as I do it for an intensity reset. And frankly, just because I have been somebody who has done the exact same exercise for years, and eventually it's kind of like, all right, like you said, Steve, like it can be very boring. And so it kind of is just a general reset that like, okay, now I'm looking forward to it a little bit more. I'm making sure my form is in check. And hey, if there is some additional fatigue management there, then great.
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm with you in terms of typically when I'm thinking about a deload, it is that full kind of reset where someone is like their motivation to train has dropped, their performance kind of across the board is either stagnated, maybe some things have dropped off. I try and avoid like them just like redlining and everything's just completely gone to shit. 'Cause it's like you probably should have backed off a little bit before that. But you've got all the signs, the telltale signs of kind of maybe a bit of an overreach state and then back off. And I've changed my, I've been much more loose with my prescriptions as I've got more experienced with deloads, when to take them, how to approach them. I'm just more focused on the overall principle of what a deload is trying to achieve versus the specific execution of a deload. It's like a deload's meant to recover you from all the training that you've kind of been doing, drop that fatigue, and set you up for a new mesocycle. That can look so many different ways in terms of length and how you approach it. So yeah, I just wanted to comment on that.
How are you guys doing any specific types of deloading for your bodybuilders, Alberto, or are you guys a little bit more lax as well?
Well, let me tell you, I haven't deloaded since, well, actually October at the I got sick, but prior to that it had been since August. So usually what I do is I'll just kind of have life's things let me deload. And then I'll try to just train in a way where it's like I can pace this and munch on it until I get to that point. So whether it's, 4 months down the road or 6 months down the road, I'll just kind of pace it a little bit differently, right? Just a different length of race. But that's where I have my stuff too. And that's something that with athletes, it's I want you to spend more time training than not. And you just get to the point where you look at all the symptoms and you can make those calls where it is a deload week. Maybe you're not motivated, you're achy, whatever. And everyone seems to prefer the, hey, let me pick like maybe 2 days so I can set myself up for like 5 consecutive days that are off, whether it's the two favorite days or the 2 days where you're like least achy or the two most important days. It could be a lot of things. Just train those 2 days and then, start the next week fresh. I think bodybuilders, or my guys, seem to enjoy that a little bit more because, man, you know how it goes sometimes with those deloads that I think borrowed a little bit too much from the strength world. It's like to come in and like these very low RPEs and like some cuts in volume and weight. You almost feel worse on those days just because I think going into those sessions, you know there isn't any trouble to get into, so you're not as aroused, and it's almost discouraging. You're like, whoa, was I that broken that, you know, 80% of my usual dumbbell press for less reps is like feeling terrible today. So yeah, 5 days off seems to be pretty good for most, or up to a week sometimes as well.
They used to get very specific articles on like, okay, keep the volume the same or go to half and half the weight, or keep the weight the same and go, half the number of sets. And I think either can be fine. I mean, depending on, I wouldn't, if you were having an injury reason you were deloading, then I would not say keep the weight the same for less sets. But what I did find those days did for me back again when I was younger and did them, they did actually get me a little bit more chomping at the bit to train again, because I'd go in and I'd get a pump, but I wasn't doing anything hard. I'm like, wait, I want to actually lift now. So that would help a little bit. But yeah, these days I'm just like, I got a lot of other stuff to do. I'm just gonna get other stuff done now.
There's almost no wrong way to drop fatigue, which is nice. It's like you can just pick.
I want to ask about gauging progress. I know we've talked before, like, I do the measurements and everything, but I don't even just mean in terms of making sure you gain muscle, but just even, I mean, we all coach people here, so assessing that, because I actually just stumbled across something. I had somebody on the podcast a year ago, and I was saying how you really have to break it down. Like I said, okay, what are you currently dumbbell shoulder pressing? And he said 70s for eight. And I said, okay, so if a year from now you were doing 70s for 12, would you be happy with that? And this was a guy who's been lifting for over 10 years. And he's like, I think that would be amazing. Like, he had a realistic view of things. Like, yeah, I mean, 50% more reps on the exercise I've been doing for many years, amazing. It's like, okay, so think about that. That means you're doing one extra rep every 13 weeks, right? Which is just very hard to gauge. And I messaged him last week and I said, hey, it's been a year. Where are we at? And he was actually saying, I wish I could do 70 for eight right now, because he had dieted a little bit. So it wasn't like a, but point is, like, he certainly didn't make any strength progress there in a whole year. And I think, I mean, we've all had dedicated strength phases and everything, so we know that that's kind of realistic, for all these things. So I don't even mean for people doing 20 plus years, but even let's say like 10 plus years, how are you for yourself and clients trying your best to be objective and accurately gauge that we are going in the right journey, especially if somebody's not nearly contest condition, where it can be harder to pinpoint these things.
Dave.
It's a good question. I bring myself back to what I mentioned before, like that process. So I'm like looking at, okay, so what do we know in terms of what we need to do training-wise to grow muscle? We need to train muscles with a sufficient amount of volume where they're challenged, and we need to train them sufficiently close to failure. And if we're doing that over and over again and looking to kind of improve that, so progress load over time or progress reps or improve technique, that also comes into it quite often, actually, where you might end up doing the same load and reps, but technique is just drastically improved or it's just different. You might be lifting it differently. I kind of focus on that and kind of make sure that that's happening. So with my clients, as we would have done, Dave, like looking at, okay, so how are you recovering between sessions? Are you getting overlapping soreness? So you kind of recovered on time. That gives us an indication of kind of how's that training frequency, but also how's that level of training volume going. So if someone's reporting to me, hey, I'm recovered like a couple of days after that session, and it's like 4 or 5 days till I train that muscle again, I'm like, oh, maybe we could increase maybe sets in that session, depending on the set volume within that session, or we could increase training frequency. So regarding the literature, I mean, there isn't even like we have this inverted U in mind in terms of training volume and muscle growth, but it doesn't seem that we actually know that that actually exists. I think it definitely exists. Like theoretically, it just makes complete sense. Like it doesn't make sense to me that it wouldn't. But I am trying to, for the people that are looking to maximize growth, I'm trying to push them with volume and intensity. And like I mentioned, after like a deload, introduce kind of have a couple of introductory weeks where we're kind of feeling out things and maybe low RARs. But then I get to a point where I'm like, we're pushing very close, if not to failure on things, or at 0 RAR with a good level of volume, and push that for as long as we can. And I'm testing them until they're like fatigued enough to need that deload. And I'm like, if we're doing that process, like that is the stimulus for growth. Like you can't be screwing that up too much. It's then looking outside of the gym. Have you got a surplus that's in place to kind of promote those adaptations and what we're trying to achieve? Have you got really good fatigue management and sleep, and stress is under control? And if all the kind of inputs are there, Like it's kind of gotta happen, and then you do assess. But it's like you said, when you've got someone as naturals, we grow so damn slowly. And if someone hasn't got a training age of like under 2 years and they've got 2 years plus under their belt, like they're not growing at dramatic rates. But I do like to see people try and hit like a PR by the end of that block of training that they're doing pre-deload, like try and hit a new one and then come back in and kind of cycle RIRs back down, cycle loads and reps back down, and then push again and try and beat it again after like a period of six, sorry, 4 to 8 weeks or something. That's kind of the goal. But then it's being realistic of how advanced are you at this point? How realistic is it for you to hit a PR after like a couple of months over and over again? It depends how new that movement is for you. Depends on the person there. But that's kind of the way I like to look at things, at least. I find when people try and assess if they're growing too much, it's kind of that. Are we there yet? Kind of scenario with the child in the back. Like, are we there? Yeah, we there yet? And it just kind of like disrupts the process. It's just like, let's keep going. Like, what would you do differently than really trying to push like to your maximum or close to volume that you can tolerate within your lifestyle and scope and intensity with good movement selection, quality nutrition, surplus protein sufficient, great sleep? Like you're doing nothing wrong. You're going to get the outcome of muscle growth eventually. It just might be a different pace depending on the person and that kind of situation, I guess.
Man, that's rough. With newer folks, it's you just have so much wiggle room, and you can almost do things per what they enjoy most, you know? Like Steve's last spurt of progress, like he was, I'd probably say that was like early advanced, you know, and still then there's a lot of things that he suspects. You know what? I could have done a little bit better, but he still grew substantially because he was checking off that list he just spoke about, you know, with training checkpoints, the lifestyle checkpoints. It amounted to something good eventually. But once we're getting, late intermediate, that's a little bit harder. And this is where you do need something to, like, I guess it's like the iPad while we're on that trip to hand over to the kids so they don't ask that question all the time. And I think this is where some sort of strength goal helps. And it's got to be something they enjoy. You know, it could be a weighted pull up. It could be deadlifting. It could be a bench press. And I think as long as we're moving the needle there, it's just easier for them to wait on these other things that just take far longer than neurological adaptations. So that's something I like to use. But I think now more than ever, what I rely on is just my eye. I can tell if someone is growing or not. Like we've all had those spurts where maybe per a lot of metrics, nothing too exciting happened, but your clothes fits differently. People are telling you that, hey man, you just look better, and you've never, in some way you can't fully describe, you're just holding on to this body weight much better. So, because at the end, our goals are visual, right? So I think it's important to learn to decipher that eye, especially when you do get to the point where, man, you might only have 3, 4 pounds of muscle to put on if you do everything right. Because those 3 to 4 pounds, again, they're top of, you know, it's on top of your pile of gains that you've already made. So they will be significant. It's just important to not be discouraged. And to me, this is, I guess, one of the reasons that I don't know, I've stayed natural is just because I have too many questions. And a natural advanced athlete is almost like having someone with like really bad genetics, only they actually adhere to the plan, right? So that's why I enjoy working on my own canvas so much. And whenever I have the privilege of working with other advanced athletes, I'm like, oh, we're going to learn so many things here that are going to be helpful when it comes to helping, say, less gifted or even less committed and gifted populations.
Do you think that, like, let's say in the future, you're now mid 40s, you're noticing some general fatigue and whatnot, you get your testosterone checked, you got low testosterone. Do you think that you'd actually almost fight the medical recommendation to go on TRT because it could skew some of this? I mean, I think both of you probably have a strong connection to being a natural athlete. Do you think that even if it was medically recommended because of all these reasons you're talking about, you'd kind of fight against it?
I've thought about this simply because, well, I don't like to be closed-minded. Like, I hate to say I'll never do this, I'll never do that. I think in that scenario, the way it plays out in my mind is the doctor tells me, he's like, bro, you're like running on 150.
Yeah.
And you know, what we need to do is, you know, this is what I recommend. I think I am so stubborn, and plus there's like the skill set part that like I probably come out of that office like telling him, I'll show you who's got low testosterone. I'll see you in 4 months, buddy, and I'm gonna do all these things to, because that is something you see with older guys that go get checked, and you know, they've spent the last 2 decades like not taking care of themselves, but here they are giving grief to like those SARMs goblins about like not being patient. It's like, bro, you haven't taken care of your body like for 22 years. Like, could you give this like a good 3 year ch like you don't deserve like overnight like good blood work and all these muscles. It doesn't work that way. So I would probably do what I can to try to figure that out first. But also at the same time, there's something with like just letting yourself like decay and age. Like that's just part of the process, right? And I know that like virtually right now, I'm gonna be 41 in March. Like in terms of like recovery, hormone status, energy, drive, all that, it feels no different than like when I was 20. The only difference is that like I guess I'm better at funneling that energy where it needs to go. But I think that's because it was the inverse of that example I made with those guys. It's like, you know, they didn't take care of themselves for decades, and I think that's why I'm here. But yeah, I don't think if I did it, I feel like I put in my time, right? And it's like, okay, like I took this pretty far, but I just don't see that happening because I think I would almost like to face that challenge and be like, all right, my body is different now. Like something happened at 50, and I think I can learn a lot from trying to work with this new system, as downgraded as it might be, and I can be of use to others as well, who better use to others who might be dealing with something similar. So I guess I want to rock this thing till the wheels fall off, basically. That's where I'm at now, but we'll see.
Interesting. I'm just curious, have you ever had your testosterone levels checked?
It was like 550.
Yeah, pretty normal.
Yeah, but all the most jack guys I've seen have the most normal test levels. That's something to throw out. It's like, I think a lot of it is like what your body does with it. Like even my thyroid is on the lower side of normal.
Yeah, really. Yeah, that is interesting. I think there is way more to thyroid than just, even your free T3. There's more to it than that. I think with Doug Miller and Lane Norton, who are both probably at the top as far as lean body mass among naturals. Obviously, they both get called out for not being naturals all the time. I think they both measured around 1,000 nanograms per deciliter testosterone. But barring them, I would agree. I mean, like Brian Borstein has talked about how his testosterone is actually pretty low. I've seen, I think, like the, again, NFL, you never really know what else is going on there. But I think there was some report about like average NFL player had like mid 300s to low 400, something like that. So clearly there is a correlation with testosterone and muscle mass, but I obviously there's way more than just that going on.
I mean, I think that's why those like high responders, like people don't believe them. Like when Bumstead talks about what he's using, you know, these kids that do local shows are pissed off because they're like, I use 4 times that amount and I don't look like you. You're lying, right? So I guess I something to think about, like with a lot of folks. I've seen guys that bench over 500 pounds and like they're in the 400s.
Sure. What about you, Steve? I know obviously, you had the past like with the accident and whatnot. What do you think for the future?
It's interesting when you said it. It's not something I've really thought too much about. But when I take it from the perspective of I'm doing everything I can be to supporting natural testosterone in the best way possible, but I'm still under like the lower end of what's like deemed as like the acceptable reference range. And if I was experiencing symptoms of low testosterone, having been there and having been out of there, I know the difference and the dramatic effect it can play on just general well-being and everything like that. So if the doctor was advising it and I'd done everything in my power to battle against it, as Alberto was saying, the benefits there and the improvement on general well-being and like life quality are like undeniable. And I can understand why people would take that route. And I think I probably would at this point when I'm thinking about it. Because like you said, I've been there kind of on the other end. And like it made such a dramatic, like it was the best thing for me at that time.
I would say I feel similarly regarding TRT as one ages. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of excuses that people use to jump on TRT like way too young these days and whatnot. But I don't really have any, you know, I know some people talk about like the noble natties and whatnot. I just don't, that's just not how I think about it. If in the same way that I'd say, look, like I tested my vitamin D levels, they were less than 20, I'm going to take vitamin D. Like I said, that's going to help me, then great. There is a plethora of data showing that low, like actually low levels of testosterone have their own health issues. And obviously, you know, you can look at correlation and whatnot. But to me, if it was like, hey, this is going to help you feel better and live better. I mean, the muscle mass, honestly, I don't even think. Some people say talk about it making a huge difference. The times I've seen it make a huge difference are one, when you have somebody who was enhanced and now they're still on TRT, it does seem that they can maintain way more muscle now than going back to, you know, Meadows has talked about this, many people have talked about this. Or if you were truly like just bottom of the barrel testosterone and now you get yourself to upper normal, then yes, I've seen that do wonders for people too. But if you're at like 200 and you go up to 600 or 700, I have a number of clients who have taken TRT. The main thing that they say are, I feel way better, my libido's back, just life is better. It's not, I mean, one of my clients, I mean, he and I have openly talked about this. He honestly doesn't look like he lifts that much. Like when we started, he was on TRT for 2 or 3 years, and he just looked like just a normal guy who'd be like an IT guy, you know, just nothing. It's not what some people make it out to be, unless they're getting into like the sports TRT world. So I just look at it like any other, you know, medicine. If it's prescribed accurately and all that, it's good for your health. Wonderful. I get what you're saying, Berto, about the maybe there's something to be said for, I don't know, like decaying and whatnot. I've seen who was it? John, who was Precision Nutrition? Is that John Berardi?
I think so.
Yeah,
I think so,
he
yeah.
made a post about that one time. He was 40, and I think he was posted about his testosterone levels. And he was saying, yeah, you know, one thing I like that as I get older, I maybe am a little subdued, and you know, it's not so much like the bull mentality anymore. Now I'm like a teacher and whatnot. I think from a mentality standpoint, that's great. You know, you take on like a different role in life than maybe your early 20s. But physically, man, if you tell me I can maintain my physicality, fantastic. Same thing with like if there's ever, you know, if Elon Musk wants to give me something to maintain IQ until I'm 90, again, obviously barring side effects, I'll take it. I'm not signing up for just unnecessarily, you know, just becoming decrepit.
No, I agree with that too. I got everything I said aside, like if it was getting to the point where it was just creating major conflict, like not using modern medicine, like what are you doing, bro? Right?
Albert, can I just ask Alberto a question? If this isn't too personal, have you done anything for hair? Because I know you've got your mane of hair. Have you done anything like, I think Eric takes finasteride.
Finasteride.
Yeah.
Oh, does Eric take finasteride? Okay.
I think he does.
No, I haven't done anything for hair on my head, but I gotta be truthful, man. That's what the brand's on, right? But I have done it. I can't say if it's worked or not for like the beard, like
Yes.
minoxidil, right? So I think it's done a little bit, but I think I'm gonna give it one more year and we'll see if it's worth it because it is kind of annoying.
So what do you get, like patchiness in the beard or something?
It's just not very, it's almost a neck beard if my head weren't so big.
Mine's a bit like that. Like it's thin here, very thick here.
I always thought you had a pretty solid beard, Steve. I never really noticed anything like that, but
I've been keeping it short recently. It's
yeah
grown a
yeah
bit more now.
I've never taken finasteride, but I have a number of friends who have taken it, and that is one of the ones where I'm always on the fence about it because most of the research would show that it's safe, it's effective, et cetera. But then, I mean, I've heard urologists on podcasts who are like, I literally would never give this to anybody. And obviously there's some of the what a post-finasteride syndrome that people fear about and how much of that is placebo. Also, some of it's like how much of it is age. You got a guy who's 40, starts taking it, now he's 45, he's like, oh, I'm having all these problems. It's like, well, yeah, you've gotten significantly older. So that's a huge confounding variable. But then also the other side, like all of my friends who tell me they've had no side effects, I'm like, yeah, but if you're getting ED, are you going to tell me that? Like, are you going to be upfront about that? My biggest concern actually would not be something like that, because that you could at least notice and stop. What I'd be concerned about would be some of the potential like depressive effects, because like your mood always fluctuates. So if your average is a 7.5 out of 10 mood, right? But one day it's a 6, one day it's an 8, one day it's an 8.5, whatever. And just gradually over a year, that slowly drops down. Like, are you really going to be able to detect that? And even then, as you guys probably know, once you stop finasteride, all of the hair you would have lost, you're now going to lose, right? You're going to shed it anyway. So now imagine like you're 2 years in, you're noticing you're more depressed, but also if you stop it, you're going to have this huge shed. So I'm just kind of like, for now, I'm just accepting it. But I don't know. I'm always on the fence about it.
That reminds me of I've seen some people in like on social media in the space I'm in who have gone assisted, and then they've been like, actually don't want to be assisted, and they stop. And I've seen people go back on
You're
because
talking about
it's
using
like
like
this,
performance enhancing drugs
yeah,
or with no.
performance enhancing drugs. And it just makes me think of that because it's the same with the finasteride. It's like, oh yeah, I'll go on it, and then like I keep all the hair or what have you, and then I come off, and then, oh, I lost everything I would have anyway. And then
Exactly.
you're like, oh, what do I do? Go back on? But it's like once you go down that path, there's no returning. But
It's tough.
yeah, I am with finasteride. It's something I've considered and turned down for all the kind of reasons you kind of mentioned, Dave. Where it's like if it can have any impact on any kind of on my bodybuilding negatively, I'm just like, no, I'm just and it, as much as I can avoid medical interventions, I will avoid it.
Yeah,
Just kind of keeping to that natty.
I'm actually surprised to hear that Eric takes it only in that I know Eric is so dedicated to anything that can help him muscularly. And like in theory, if you're decreasing DHT, I mean the testosterone actually goes up slightly, but also your estrogen could go up a little bit. I mean there are not super there actually there's pretty much I don't think any good studies on this, but theoretically you could paint a picture where it could be a little harder to get lean and things like that. So it's interesting that he tested it out, and obviously it hasn't been a problem for him.
He's gotten great results too. Like it's pretty crazy.
Hair-wise, you mean?
Hair-wise.
I've actually noticed that. And
It's
I was like,
reversing.
yeah, I was like, oh, actually, his hair at one point wasn't, not that it's something I really focus on, but there was one time I saw him and I was like, oh, like your hair looks good. So guess it's working. Good job, Eric. All kinds of gains these years. So you guys both told me how you've changed your perspective a little bit with some of the studies and the meta regression that came out regarding failure. We also had a newer study on volume, right? Which recommends that everybody do 52 sets per week for body part to failure, right? For awesome gains. But no, I know there was a lot of controversy there. I'm just curious how you guys felt about did that one change anything for you, or was it just kind of like, all right, like we know generally more volume is better, but I'm just going to keep it within the limits. Any change there for your training?
I guess, yeah, for me, no. I didn't look at it and have the response some people did, where it's like, oh, they clearly weren't training hard enough or whatever, like lab setting, or oh, these guys don't even lift. It's just not possible. In fact, Milo did the workout. Milo Wolf went through the entire, like, I think
Didn't
it
Lyle
was,
pay him like $1,000 or something for
I don't know
that?
if that's publicly, yeah, it's public knowledge. So, yeah, he did, which is fantastic. At least Lyle's a man of his word, isn't he? So, credit to him, credit to him for that. But kind of yet to eat his shorts in a sense, I guess, because it was possible. And when you think about it, like they acclimated up to that over time. They were only training their quads and then hamstrings at like maintenance, and then maybe upper body they did a little bit. And they were reducing loads to keep them in a rep range. So it's like, and short rest periods. So you just think about the quality of those sets every time in terms of that muscular stimulus, but even the fatigue side. Like if you're going through like a leg press, and you want like 2 minutes rest after hitting failure or close to. I think they were actually an RAR for the majority of the sets, and then they started taking it to failure at the end. Like you're just reducing the loads to a point where it's like you're doing 50% of the working weight you were using for the first set. So it wasn't kind of how, if like ecologically valid is the term. It's just not how most bodybuilders train in the real world, I think. I think some maybe do, and I mean they can see great results, but they have to do really high volumes because of the way it kind of goes, where you see that drop in quality. So yeah, when I brought on Brad, Milo and Dr. Pat to talk about it, and did this just change the recommendation of that like 10 to 20 kind of set volume guideline as a general baseline? Like, no, it doesn't change that. And I've got one of the authors, Eduardo, from the paper coming on. Actually, I've already done the podcast with him, and that's
Cool.
coming out where he just gives out tons of caveats basically to the volume research because he's headed up quite a lot of those papers. And I don't know if you've seen it, both of you, that Lyle did a recent video that was on the paper that came out with Samuel Buckner and Holly Baxter. It was basically putting doubt in some of the research in terms of how they take like muscle thickness measurements, things like this. Like, are we waiting enough time to take a muscle thickness measurement? Like, that's based off kind of set volume data where they're not taking as many sets as like they were in this study to failure. And is there an edema effect that's impacting the results there? So it was a interesting skeptical look at things. And I'll also be spoiler alert, they'll be coming on. I've got like a I guess a debate gonna happen with Menno Josh Pelland, who's doing a meta-analysis currently on volume for hypertrophy, and then Sam and Holly will be coming on as well. So that should be interesting, just because obviously
The
Menno's
five
opted
of them are coming
perspective.
on to debate, you're saying?
Four, well, including me, it's five of us. Yeah, it's a little bit
Oh, wow,
much,
that's going to be tough.
but I think it's like Josh is going to be there with his meta-analysis like data in his head to come in and kind of give his points. And then I guess Sam and Holly, Sam probably, or Samuel, I don't know if he'd like Sam, he like head up that paper, so he'll probably do the majority of the talking. Holly will come in with her experience and point of views, and then Menno will have the like kind of the perspective of what most of the people in the evidence-based space have had, where there is a dose response to volume and that kind of trusting in the data that the 48 hours is enough time to allow for that inflammation not to impact muscle thickness results and things like this. But it'll be interesting to kind of see what comes from that. But I think it was a worthwhile, I think it will help the space anyway, because throwing some skepticism on some of the kind of broader claims, you sometimes learn things like, I don't know, I always think about, I used to be dead set on P ratios and staying leaner for optimized muscle growth to fat gain. And obviously Eric Trexler threw a ton of shade on that and was like, oh, actually, there's not much good data to support this claim, and maybe you don't need to worry about it. And that certainly helped my growth. So
Totally. And you feel similarly, Alberto, keep as far as not really changing much with it.
I think the issue that some people have with research is what it's the strength of research is the fact that it answers like one question at a time. Like that is these same people often are complaining about how enhanced guys can't really speak on this and that because there's too many variables at play. So you have to take it for what it is, and I think the whole there's a volume response, that there's a pattern there when it comes to the relationship between muscle growth and volume. Yeah, absolutely. But from a more practical standpoint, I think a good comparison is like caloric deficits, right? It's like, yeah, if you're in a 1,000 calorie deficit, that is going to remove fat at a faster rate than, say, 500. But there's consequences and small print that you have to examine if you want to head in that direction. Everything from the context of the athlete's individual situation, like maybe they come from a disordered eating background with volume. It's like, what is our orthopedic history like? So there's all these bottlenecks like along the way that you have to take into consideration. And for me, I've always been kind of like the way I handle deloads. It's like, what's the longest runway I can create? So like, who cares if we have this very spurty 2 years in our training, and then all of a sudden, we're just hampered by all these orthopedic issues that we developed because of those 2 years. So it doesn't change much other than for me, other than yeah, it's good to know that. It's good to confirm that because that often is the tool that we use when if technique is in order, exercise selection is in order, and they're recovering well, it's like, well, let's do more for that area. But then again, you're also moving around all these other things because there is only so many like recovery units to go around.
Right.
So yeah, I guess my standpoint's a little bit more practical and that like, yeah, you probably can. You could do some crazy things. Like there's people who ran that, what was it, Smolov or the squat, they got sensational gains. And I always compared that to like that was like the crash diet for like power lifters. You know, it's like quick 50 pounds, but there might be small print that comes with it.
Right. Sure, definitely. Cool guys. So I want to put each of you on the spot for 2024. I just started the year. So what is something that you're looking forward to within the space this year? This could be research that's being done. This could be somebody who's new in the space that you want to see what they're doing. It could be a particular bodybuilder. It could be a new supplement that's going to put on 10 pounds of muscle for you this year. What is something you're looking forward to?
I wish I could come out with a joke, but I'm just not that guy. Like I start, I'm that person who starts telling a joke and just starts laughing, and I'm like, yeah, I can't keep a serious face on. The first thing that came to mind actually is, and I know this is a very selfish one, but I haven't been coached in a decade, and I'm officially just started some coaching with Cliff Wilson.
Oh, cool,
So
man.
he's taken the reins on my nutrition, and he will be doing my nutrition, and maybe I'll be kind of giving up my training at some point. I don't know. I'm open to the idea that that could happen. It's something I'm a bit precious about, I guess. But yeah, I wanted someone just in my corner to just take that over and not have to think about it when I'm taking athletes to stage. And also, I haven't had a coach in my corner since my first prep. Now, a decade on, I thought it was about time to see how that experience could go. And I mean, Cliff's kind of record speaks for itself, so I'm hoping I can get to some sort of condition that he brings in most of his guys, and maybe a level above what I normally could, and see if I can get further than I could on my own. So I'm just excited to be a bit of a client. It's been interesting already because I particularly went with Cliff, one, because I've met him in person. We've spoken many times on the podcast, but he does things different to how I would, and I'm kind of interested to learn what's kind of the method behind the madness in some of those areas. And I think it'll be really good for me, not just as a competitor, but also as a coach myself.
And this is specifically for your contest prep.
So I started like 3 weeks ago, but I just wanted to, like I don't want to be that guy that's like 8 weeks out and being like, hey, can you take the reins? I'm like, come on, Steve, like do as you would want your client to do. So I reached out before Christmas and just
Okay.
we started getting the ball rolling recently. Yeah.
Nice, man. That's awesome. All right, Mr. Nunez.
Well, I guess three things, right? Because at least that's how I understood it. So I'd like to see, I guess because I get so much from the evidence-based world. I'd like to see us continue to bridge the gap between some things that like the bros have been doing for like ever, and we've kind of discounted. I think there's a lot of good research ideas to come from there, you know. I don't know, like did athletes who got a better pump see more growth, you know, like things like that.
I think there is
I like,
research happening on that, by the way, Berta. I think they're
yeah,
looking into it.
so
Yeah, the guys at Data Driven Strength, I think Jake is doing some research on that.
cool.
Something on that lines.
Also I would like to see more of these studies that involve exercise just be recorded. Like all I do is run experiments with like my athletes, and to me it's like, okay, that's what the spreadsheet says, but I need to see what is happening. Like what did this progress look like? Because there's a lot of things, like I don't know, a squat study, like you know, oh, you can see why people in this group got this much quad growth relative to say glute growth just because of the way they were put together. For example, the way they fold on a squat. So, and I think it would gain a lot of trust and traction that what is taking place there is taking place. I can't run my experiments without like video data. Like that is something that I'm constantly on my athletes about. So I think that would be good. I trust that what's taking place is taking place. But at the same time, I think it would help bridge that gap so that other folks could see they're like, oh, okay, that was like legit failure, you know? On my end, geez, I'd like to win a world title. And if I can do that this year, that'd be great. But I think more than any, I'd like to, you know, as you evolve and you change as a person, it's like, okay, now I have a kid and possibly kids in the future. I'd like to set that example, and I'm excited about that, to try to figure this stuff out and improve my skill set when it comes to helping people who are in similar situations when, you know, they're not necessarily the most important thing in their life anymore.
Right.
So yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to.
That's awesome, man. And I should know this by now, but when you said win world, so I believe all of you guys were pros in another division before. Is that accurate? And now Eric is a WNBF pro. And are you and Jeff WNBF pros?
Yeah.
Okay.
When I got my pro cards, I ended up getting every pro card you could really get at the time.
Okay.
But it wasn't like I from the beginning I wanted that WNBF pro card just because over the year it's just been the one that holds the most weight. Where
Yeah.
if you want like good competition, especially international competition, that's the one you get. So that's why I'm so focused on that federation. But wherever the shows are, the tested shows are, like that's where I'll float over the years, wherever the best ones are at.
Yeah. Awesome, guys. All right. Well, I think people know you, but where can we find more of your stuff? Steve, you can go first.
Cool. Yeah, I'm hoping I might be able to join them on that pro, that WNBF pro card. That's at least my goal. A world title, man, that would be amazing. But like, that'll be a very, very cool thing to achieve. But anyway, I'll stop rambling. Revivestronger.com is the website. You can find the podcast. You can find our coaching, everything there. I'm Revive Stronger on Instagram, which is where I'm most active. And I've kind of mentioned the podcast a few times, but the Revive Stronger podcast, I'd be remiss not to say it. I get to talk to amazing, smart people over there, and it's a fun time. So, yeah, thank you for having me on, Dave.
Yeah, of course.
3DMuscleJourney.com. You can find everything we put out there, from our courses to our coaching, to all the individual coaches, Instagrams, and whatever social media they work with. But yeah, no, that's it. I think it's all consolidated. 3DMuscleJourney.com.
Cool. All right. Thanks, guys.